Is it the case that you go, I don't know what's wrong with this patient? It's got to be neurological. Send it Absolutely. To the neurologist.
Absolutely. Yes. Anything with depression or tremors, which can include shivering, apparently, or a strange posture or anything that comes and goes, kind of by default, half the time ends up in neurology.
So how many of those do you end up sending back to medicine or to surgery or something?
Oh, no. Usually by the time they get to me, they've been through everyone else, so I have nowhere else to send them.
And then you put them on preds and hope for the best.
Yeah, but I've got a good reason why.
Who loves neurology? When you look at that consult list and you see under reason for visit, acting strange, or circling to one side, or seizures, do you go, ugh, or do you go, hey, that sounds like a fun challenge? So why is that? Here's what I think. When we get that ugh feeling, it's often a case of lack of clarity. I'm unclear on how to approach this case, unclear on what my steps are, and unclear on what to advise the client. And generally, the type of people who become vets like to know their stuff, right? We don't like that feeling of, I don't know what I'm doing here. So let's get some clarity on this topic. The inflammatory brain diseases, the GMEs and MUOs and steroid responsive meningitises and whatever else. Just the list of names is confusing. In this episode, we have specialist veterinary neurologist Dr. Sam Long from the Veterinary Referral Hospital in Melbourne to help us make sense of which diseases what, and to teach us what to be on the lookout for to make sure we don't miss the inflammatory brain diseases in the consult room. Sam gives us a clear plan for getting to a diagnosis, including how to make sense of serology testing for infectious brain disease, as well as some new tools in our lab testing toolbox. And of course, how to treat these diseases once we do have a diagnosis, or even if we don't manage to get to a final diagnosis because of finances or whatever else. Now, quick clarification on something. You'll hear us talk about serology testing. You know, the IgG and IgM panels for Toxo and Neo and LCAT Crypto and all of those funky kind of things. And you'll also hear us talk about the new, or at least new to me, neurology PCR panels, which I was thrilled to learn about because goodness knows we can use all the help we can get for these cases. If you haven't heard of them yet, there are now PCR tests available for the common infectious organisms that can affect the nervous system and that we need to rule out when we're chasing a diagnosis for neuro disease. If you're in Australia, you can get these done at whichever of the labs that are part of the SVS pathology network you're using. So that's Vetnostics, VetPath, ASAP Laboratory, and QML Vetnostics, depending on where you are. You'd have heard us talk about them in previous episodes as a financial supporter of the podcast, and they are kindly supporting this episode as well, which is convenient because I needed some clarification. So, as you'll hear in the episode, deciding whether to send bloods for serology or CSF for PCR or maybe sending both is still a tricky decision, even if you're a neurologist. Each test has pros and cons, and each test adds value and has limitations. So I spoke to our pathologist friends at the SVS Pathology Network, which for me here in Queensland is QML Vetnostics. And the takeaway from that conversation was that as a practicing vet, you don't need to know and remember all of the ins and outs. You just need to remember the phone number of your SVS Pathology Network pathologist. When you get that neuro's case, make your diagnostic plan. But before you start sticking needles into spinal cords or sending bloods or whatever, hop on the phone to your pathologist to talk through the case. They're smarter than you and they're very nice. Okay, let's get to it. Dr. Sam Long and the inflammatory brain diseases. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us on the VetVault to talk neurology, because
not at all.
All GP vets love brain cases, right?
Oh, absolutely. Isn't that their favorite specialization?
Why is it so intimidating, do you think, Sam?
I don't know. I wonder if it's because there's a lot of anatomy. You know, when we sort of teach students in vet school, there's a hell of a lot of, you know, forebrain, midbrain, brainstem, proprioceptive pathways, motor neurons, upper motor neurons. There's a lot of terminology and a lot of anatomy, and I think that gets a bit daunting for people a lot of the time. But it's not that hard. I mean, I'm a neurologist. I wouldn't be doing it if it was really hard.
So our topic for today, so when I was preparing for this, I
I realized you can go so vast when it's veterinary neurology. So should we try and focus on, I don't know, do we call it the inflammatory neurological diseases, encephalitis type syndromes? Does that make sense? Is that a good thing to group together?
Sure. Do you want to include I'm going to use this word and hate myself for doing it. Do you want to include the meningitis story as well?
Yeah, definitely. Is there any other kind?
Well, no, I think it's useful because the word meningitis gets thrown around like almost nothing else really by all sorts of vets. And I think it's worth reminding people of a couple of things. Number one, I'm going to turn into the lecturer. When we talk literally about all of the itises, whether it's encephalitis, whether it's meningitis, whether it's myelitis, literally what we're talking about is inflammation. So inflammatory cells coming and infiltrating an organ or a tissue and causing a response that's driven by the immune system. Meningitis just means that inflammatory reaction is within the meninges. So the outer layer of either the brain or the spinal cord, both of them are covered with meninges. We use this word very commonly because meningitis is a really relatively common and pretty well understood condition in people. But there is a major difference between the human and the veterinary world. So less than 2% of all meningitis cases in dogs particularly are infectious. And the vast majority of meningitis in people is infectious, either viral or bacterial, you know, meningococcal and all of those conditions. So when we talk about meningitis, we do it, but it's much, much more common that when we see meningitis in our patients, it's going to be as part of an immune-mediated disease or an autoimmune disease.
Wow, less than 2%.
It's very, very uncommon to see infection. I mean, as a general rule, infection in the CNS of dogs and cats is pretty rare. It's much more common that you're going to have other drivers of inflammation. And mostly that means autoimmune disease or immune-mediated disease, which is one of the occasions where we're a little bit different people compared with dogs and cats. Infection is much, much more common for us than it is for dogs and cats.
One of the first things that I normally try and start when I tackle a topic is to make sure we don't miss it or to get it on the radar or off the radar when we see something. So when we're zooming in on these, let's call them these immune-mediated or inflammatory-related brain diseases, are there things that will move it up on the DD list compared to a tumor or epilepsy or a neurotoxin or something like that? Or is it kind of all the same potential presentation?
It can be enormously variable. So I guess it's probably worth starting off by making sure we know what we're talking about. So for me as a neurologist, the inflammatory diseases that I think of when I'm thinking of immune-mediated disease, so we'll leave the infections aside for now, but when I'm thinking of immune-mediated disease in the brain or the spinal cord, dogs and cats, the things that I would consider would be MUO, so meningoencephalitis of unknown origin. I would consider a couple of other quirky things like cerebellar or corticosteroid responsive tremor syndrome is probably the best name for what we once called shaker dog disease or white hairy shaker disease or idiopathic cerebellitis. And then I would include SRMA or corticosteroid responsive meningitis arteritis. Those would probably be my big three when you're thinking of non-infectious immune-mediated disease in the brain and spinal cord of dogs and cats.
What about GME, granulomatous?
Yeah, okay. So MUO is this basket term for meningoencephalitis of unknown origin. Is now this huge basket term for what includes both GME and all of the breed-associated encephalitis. So you've probably come across pug encephalitis, Yorkshire Terrier encephalitis, Maltese Terrier encephalitis, Chihuahua encephalitis, all these sorts of things. Within that basket, I do think about the two groups as separate, but you can't be absolutely sure from an MRI and CSF tap which one is which. The only way you can tell for sure is to have a bit of the brain under a microscope in front of you. And both of them, we use the same drugs to treat, and they both, within that sort of basket, both the GME and all of the others tend to end up having the same survival times with the treatments that we use, which is why we put them all in the one big basket. So GME, we've known about since the 60s and 70s, 1960s and 70s. And in the very, very early days, there was some discussion about it being a form of cancer, probably lymphoma related. When you have a look at dogs with GME and you have a look at their brains under the microscope, they have this amazing immune response, which is so full of lymphocytes and mononuclear cells, plasma cells and macrophages. And those cells are so busy that you often have a huge ton of mitotic figures on the microscope field in front of you. So it really can look a lot like a tumor in some respects. And once upon a time, the GME used to be called inflammatory reticulosis. And the other end of this funny condition called reticulosis was called neoplastic reticulosis. And that was then reclassified as B-cell lymphoma. So there are some bits of GME that in the past we've wondered about whether it could be a type of tumor, but we think it probably isn't. And then all of the other diseases which we've seen probably from the 1980s onwards, when pug encephalitis was first identified, those forms of encephalitis look much more, the inflammation when you look at these brains histologically is much quieter. It's more like these are brains where great big areas have just died and been wiped out and you're left with holes in the brain and a much quieter immune response around the edges. And that's the same whether you're looking at the pugs or the chihuahuas or the Maltese terriers or the Yorkshire terriers. You know, it's a necrotizing process that the immune response is there, but the end result is death of the tissue. So you end up with sort of lakes of fluid. And when you look at those guys on MI, you see, you know, holes effectively that are just full of fluid, not much in the way of contrast uptake, usually not much in the way of swelling or huge numbers of inflammatory cells coming into the brain and making it bigger on one side compared to the other. Whereas GME sometimes is much more, some GME cases look like they have cancer when you look at them on MR. And yet you put all of these dogs on, you know, corticosteroids plus one of a number of other immunomodulatory drugs, and they all get better and they all live for about the same amount of time.
And what about because you differentiated steroid responses, meningoencephalitis, arthritis from the MUOs. How's that different pathologically and management
and everything else? So SRMA is the, when neurologists get together, they use all of the letters, and SRMA is the one that we tend to pull out for these guys. So the classic picture is a young large breed dog with neck pain and pyrexia. You know, the Labradors, Golden Retrievers, Weimaraners, and similar sort of large breed dogs. Essentially what you're working up is a pyrexia of unknown origin with neck pain initially. And those guys you put into the MRI, you find nothing. So it's not quite true. You find almost nothing in the spinal cord. Sometimes you'll find a bit of inflammation, interestingly, within the muscle for reasons that we don't really understand. And you put those dogs on immunosuppressive doses of steroids, but you can get them off immunosuppressive doses of steroids and cure them effectively. So MUO cases tend to be smaller breeds and tend to be older. The SRMA tend to be large breed dogs and younger, mostly presenting just with neck pain and pyrexia, occasionally some neurological deficits, but not much. So those guys look like they have spinal cord disease, where the MUO cases, again, mostly look like they have brain disease.
That's really useful. So when we say steroid responsive, the MUOs are also steroid responsive, but not as responsive.
Yeah, so the MUOs, I sort of think of them a little bit like treating cancer. We think we can put them into remission for long periods of time, but almost always they're going to come back eventually, and ultimately we'll kill the animal. Most of the time these days we get several years before that happens, but probably a fatal disease.
All right. That helps a lot. In terms of pathogenesis, do we understand, is it simply autoimmune disease like an IMHA or a whatever, but except instead of red blood cells, the immune system starts bullying the nervous system?
Yeah, essentially. And the honest answer is no, we don't know. There have been some people that have done some pretty extensive hunting for infectious triggers or causes. So then we've pretty consistently failed to find any evidence of infectious causes. None of this is very conclusive and doesn't get us very much further than the fact that it's basically an immune system attack on the brain. Presumably, there's a genetic component just because we see it much more commonly in some breeds and some types of dog, I would say, as in small dogs as opposed to small breeds rather than large breeds of dogs. Increasingly, you know, we expect to see MUO in just about any small breed of dog these days. And so there must be something about the genetics that make you a pug or a Maltese or a Chihuahua that makes it more likely that you're going to get this inflammatory response. But we don't know what it is. It's certainly not a single gene that's the problem. It's going to be multigenic or polygenic in nature, if it is.
Sorry, I just had a thought that pugs, chihuahuas, and Malteses are so stupid they're actually allergic to their own brains. That mean?
Interesting thought.
If you're too smart, then your immune system says, no, you can't be a real pug. We have to kill your brain cells off. So back to that initial consult. The small dog that comes in with neuro signs, are there things that are going to take it off the DD list for us? Like age or presenting signs or?
I was going to say generally doesn't happen in old dogs, but on Tuesday I saw a 14-year-old Yorkshire Terrier that looks like he's got it. So not necessarily. The thing that makes me really think of MUO classically would be what we would talk about as multifocal localization. So, you know, as neurologists, we're pretty simple types and we generally start when we see our patients with this basic assumption that there is only one problem in one part of the nervous system. And you explain all of your, when we localize things with our neuro exam, you explain all of the abnormalities and the normal stuff with this one lesion in one part of the brain or spinal cord sort of idea. But with these guys, we generally or often will see things that are not just in one place. Often you'll see asymmetric signs. So changes, for instance, in the left forebrain or signs that suggest you've got a problem in the left forebrain and also the right vestibular system or right forebrain and also maybe something else going on the left side of the brain somewhere else. So by and large, the kind of the classic presentation, you know, the one that you never actually see, but that's in all the textbooks, is one of multifocal disease that's asymmetric. So that's probably the strongest giveaway. The other thing I would say, it's a little bit of a sort of a pretty subtle thing. The general theme for the MUO cases is that they're almost always intracranial. So it's almost always just brain disease, even though we're talking about multifocal disease. And pretty much exclusively the necrotizing group, the pug, chihuahua, Maltese, Yorkshire Terrier group of diseases, those guys end up having their lesions restricted to the brain, where in GME you can have a lesion just in the spinal cord or in the brain and the spinal cord.
Do these guys normally seizure? Like a seizuring dog, it is on your list of DDs?
Yes, it is. And, you know, the deal with seizures in general, when I'm talking to the residents or to the owners, is that I say, you know, when you see seizures, that is just an indication that you've got a problem in the forebrain. If you see seizures, that's just a sign that the forebrain is unhappy. Of that, there's this enormous list of differentials that can cause seizures within the forebrain. And one of those things is inflammatory disease, and in particular, MUO.
And then we mentioned the SRMAs are often painful. When I hear encephalitis, I think of pain. Do the GMEs and these sort of the MUAs often present with neck pain or spinal pain or anything, or not really?
No, usually not. A couple of other things that are generally fit the pattern but aren't exclusive would be something that's been progressing for a little while. So something that hasn't, you know, the dog hasn't been normal yesterday and is suddenly abnormal today. Usually these are conditions that progress over a few days or a week or a few weeks. As always, exceptions to every rule, but that's the general pattern. Not usually painful, but occasionally, because there are no pain receptors or nerve endings within the brain or the spinal cord itself. You don't feel pain because of a problem within your brain. You feel pain if you've got something like hydrocephalus that's expanding your cerebral hemorrhage brain enough to squash your meninges. SRMA is painful because you have inflammation within the meninges. But if the inflammation is just in the brain or the spinal cord, generally speaking, non-painful.
Okay. So these are going to be small breed dogs that are seizuring or circling or having weird behavioral changes or less.
So common things would be cortical blindness, so loss of vision in one eye that is not accompanied by a change in PLR. So if the pupil is still responsive to light on both sides, but your menace response is absent on one side, for instance, and the animal's not seeing, then that would indicate that it's a forebrain cause of blindness rather than an ocular or cranial nerve 2. Circling, the usual forebrain signs, circling, hemiparesis, corticus, proprioceptive deficits on the side opposite the lesion, getting stuck in corners, head pressing, all that sort of stuff, seizures. Plus or minus stuff going on in the hind brain as well. So cerebellar signs or cranial nerve deficits that are associated with the brainstem, that sort of thing.
So are we at chasing a diagnosis for them?
Usually you need some sort of imaging, and sadly MR is both the most expensive and the best. CT it's not at all uncommon for you to miss some of these lesions if you're looking for them on CT, where MR is going to show you what the lesions are and probably to some extent going to help you sort out whether it's GME or necrotizing encephalitis if you care that much about which one is which, based on, since we treat them both the same, you may not be that fast. That and CSF tap, so doing a spinal tap afterwards.
Quick break to plug our clinical podcasts. So we talked about clarity around our cases at the start of this episode and about how feeling unclear can affect how you feel about work. And that's the goal with our clinical podcasts. More clarity on more things presented in a format that you'll actually use and that's easy to consume. Our clinical podcasts are conversations with specialists where I ask all the questions that I've struggled with or been confused about or gotten stuck on or seen others get stuck on over my career. These are not lectures, and they're not the definitive guide on any one topic. They're there to fill in the gaps and get some real and practical advice from people who are the best in their field that you can use today in your next case. And the ultimate goal with these is not just to know more, it's to understand more and to feel better, because it feels great to be just a little bit better than you were yesterday. Go and try it for free at vvn.supercast.com.
So in the GP clinic or in the emergency clinic, you have your neuro's case. It's showing all these signs. From what you said there, I mean, less than 2% are going to be infectious. I'm trying to think of your initial workup. Before I send it to Sam, what should I be doing?
So it's always a good thing to make sure you've done blood work. There are a couple of things you can do. If it is a patient where SRMA is on the list, then CRP is often very, very high. So it's a marker. It's not terribly specific. So a whole bunch of other things will also make CRP high. But it's one more thing that adds to them. And one of the other things you can do is go some way towards ruling out the infectious causes of inflammation by looking for serology, for Neospora, Toxoplasma, check for crypto as well, do an LCAT.
So if you say serology, something crossed my radar the other day that there's now potentially PCR tests for these things. Because it used to be I'd send these seizure panels off, going, yeah, I'm getting nothing back. It's going to be $400 or $500 for no results. Or even worse, I get a result, but it's that iffy. Yeah, has been exposed in the past, but blah, blah. And you go, oh, that means nothing. So are we changing? Is anything new?
Yeah, so there is this PCR panel that you can run, and it looks for, in dogs, Toxoplasma, Neospora, distemper, and Angiostrongylus. And in cats, it looks for Toxoplasma, Cryptococcus. Actually, Cryptococcus is on the canine one as well. So a couple of things. Number one, whatever test you run, ideally it's best run on CSF, because if you're finding either DNA of the organism that you're looking for or antibodies in your CSF then that means that whatever you're looking for and have found is being made in the central nervous system. Slight caveat on that, if you do a CSF tap and you get a ton of blood, then that rule doesn't quite apply because it could be leakage from the systemic circulation. But by and large, you know, things like antibodies and DNA of organisms that you pick up in on a clean CSF tap have to have been made within the central nervous system. And you would think that if you're looking for DNA of an organism with PCR, given how incredibly sensitive the technology is, if you find the DNA in the central nervous system, it's absolutely got to be the case that the infection is there. And if you don't find it, equally that the infection isn't there. In my experience, neither of those two things is absolutely bulletproof. So a couple of things. If you've got a little bit of DNA of an organism that's buried deep within the parenchyma of a tissue, it might never get to a surface where CSF is flowing and therefore allow it to be picked up by your PCR, even though whatever it is, you know, what is it, 1 mL of a substance in an Olympic-sized swimming pool containing DNA is sufficient for you to be able to detect it on PCR as a general rule. But that still will see false negatives. And we'll also see false positives. So just because you've got DNA of an organism in your central nervous system doesn't mean that the organism is alive or causing an infection. So in an ideal world with clients for whom money is not a particularly big problem, that your safest bet is actually to combine both serology and PCR panels on your CSF profile.
So serology, I'm checking for antibodies. PCR is checking for DNA of the organism. In my head, surely you're going to be more reliably picking up DNA than antibodies, or not necessarily.
You would think so, wouldn't you? But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think you've got to put all of these things, you've got to add everything up together. You've got to put the PCR results together with what you've seen on the MRI and the CSF cell count looks like and all that sort of thing.
But I'm looking for a shortcut. You're not giving me any shortcuts.
Sorry.
Damn it.
We're not very good at dealing with shortcuts. Yeah, it can be quite frustrating sometimes.
So let's say, as you say, in an ideal world, so you're going to ask before it gets to you, is it worth sending blood for serology and PCR? Or do you just go, look, let's just go for CSF if you can?
It's a useful thing to do because if you do get a screamingly high titer to Neospora or Toxo, for instance, then you can say, this may well be the case that we've got an answer. Again, putting it into context with everything else, your neuro exam and whether that fits with what the patient's doing and so on and so forth. But yeah, if you get a Toxo titer of 1 in 1,048 or even probably 1 in 512, you can say, okay, that's a real number. Anything lower than that, I tend to think of as a little bit equivocal. Some people, you know, most labs will probably say a titer of over 1 in 64 is suspicious. I like to see greater than 1 in 512 to be certain of an active infection. IgM and IgG, in fact, the other side of the other issue is that when you're looking for titers against, in particular, the protozoal diseases, Toxo and Neospora, IgG and IgM, the labs will sort of give you often this little guide to whether one is high and the other is not high and whether that means it's an active infection or a recent previous infection or just previous exposure. I tend to put more weight on absolute numbers.
And then how do we interpret the PCRs? Is a positive a positive? If I get back crypto, yeah, there's crypto in the blood.
So the PCR on blood may not be terribly helpful. Serology is probably much more useful, I would have said. So I tend to reserve PCR for just looking at CSF samples. And the point of this, you know, if we're talking about the MUOs in general, what we're looking for is to find none of these. You know, you want to say that there is no infection going on. So you want all of your PCRs ideally to be negative. I've certainly had cases where everything else really fits with MUO. One of the PCR results has come back as being positive, and I've said, are you absolutely sure? And if you talk to the lab and you get them to rerun the sample, that is it's worth rechecking if it doesn't fit, if you've got a positive result and the animal has, let's say, a three-year-old pug with four brain signs and some evidence of asymmetry, and you really, really are suspicious of MUO, double check the positive PCR. It's more likely to be a false positive.
Right. So let's say you've got the client and they don't have all the money in the world, and it's that sort of Nero's case. Is that something you'd leave out of your workup?
Yeah, I think so. I would probably, if they've got the money, I'd do serology. Then you're left with a best guess scenario, which is where things get a little bit tricky. So you've got a little bit of, okay, well, MUO is top of our differential list because, again, the breed's right, the age is right, and it's a multifocal intracranial localization. But you're still not entirely sure. Then all you can do is say, look, I think it is, but I can't be absolutely sure. The gamble is that what you're needing to do is to treat with immunosuppression. And if there is an infection there, even though it's unlikely, things could go south very quickly. I'll often do the halfway house is to start with anti-inflammatory doses of prednisolone with clindamycin at the same time. And then if you get to the point where there's some signs of improvement and you know that there's, you know, you can't get any further diagnostically, then you can say, okay, well, we're going to take this gamble. And as long as the owners are on side and you've scared them as much as you can with the consequences of immunosuppression in an animal that hasn't had a complete diagnosis, it's all you can do. Because the alternative is, you know, if it is MUO, it's going to be very rapidly fatal if you don't do anything.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the client then that can go further. So you've done serology in-house. You've done full bloods. Full bloods worth it? Yeah, looking for liver issues, things like that.
Yeah. Certainly. I mean, there are some of these cases will only just present with full brain signs or with seizures. So certainly full bloods. And if there's any indication that there's liver disease, you know, bile acid tolerance tests also useful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've done all those, done serology, they're negative. So next step is CSF or imaging?
I much prefer to do imaging plus CSF if the CSF is indicated. The reason being that it's not that uncommon. I mean, CSF taps are occasionally a very risky and a dangerous thing to do if you've got some cause of raised intracranial pressure and you haven't identified that. Because if you've got, you know, let's say it's an obstructive hydrocephalus that you haven't picked up and there's a huge amount of pressure within the skull, you do a CSF tap. And what you're doing is releasing the pressure on the outside of the skull and setting up this pressure differential, high pressure within the skull, low pressure outside the skull. And in an attempt to equalize the pressure, the brain is going to try and leave the skull, which is
never a good idea when your brain tries to leave your skull, is it?
No, absolutely. So you can get fatal transforaminal herniation in those situations. So if at all possible, I will do the imaging first, make sure there isn't raised intracranial pressure or something else that raises the risk of CSF taps. And then when I'm happy, I'll do the CSF tap. In an ideal world, it's the combination of those two things that gives you your diagnosis.
Okay, but you're not going to pick up that pressure clinically. It's going to be an imaging.
No, there are a few things that can help. So in general, animals that are really, really dull, that can be an indicator of high intracranial pressure. It's just not a terribly specific, helpful neurological finding. And some of the time, if you do a fundic exam, you may see papilledema, so swelling of the optic nerve. That can be a useful hallmark of raised intracranial pressure. Again, not a guarantee is the problem. So sometimes you can be surprised and find a patient that has been walking around as though nothing's wrong, has tons of swelling going on, and you end up going, oh, I'm very glad we did the MRI. We're not going to do the CSF tap on this one.
So I'm just trying to picture a scenario the owner that can't go for imaging, or you're stuck in the middle of the country where there's no imaging available. Is it worth doing a CSF tap? Is it worth drooling out things if you have the technical skills?
Yeah, if you've got enough, so if the skills are there and you're, and it's all you've got and the owners are happy to take the risk, then that's better. It's probably better than doing nothing, probably, but you do have to warn them that this, you know, you could do the CSF tap and that could be the end of everything if that's the case and you've missed it. In general, you know, if the animal is relatively bright and is looking like it's not tremendously sick, that's a terribly vague thing to say, I know, but you know, the ones that have raised intracranial pressure will often, and they will often look like there's something seriously wrong with them. And if that's not the case, then you can say to people, look, there's absolutely definite risk that things could go terribly wrong, but the option is to do immunosuppression blindly. But otherwise, your alternative is again, best guess. You know, we rule out the infections that we can, and then we start with anti-inflammatory doses of prednisone and clindamycin, give us a week or so to cover everything. And if there's some improvement, then you could say, okay, let's try immunosuppression. And that's the best you can do in that scenario.
Okay. The scenario of taking a CSF tap when you're not in a specialist center or not right next to the lab, I've heard before that it doesn't transport well, doesn't hold well as a sample. Is it worth doing at all? Like, what are you going to learn from a sample that's going to take 2 days to get to the lab from Alice Springs? Or
yeah, if you're a long way away from a lab, then probably not worth doing it. There are kind of ways that you can look at CSF samples yourself if you have a hemocytometer and you're good at, you know, if you're familiar with it and you're good at using it. You can take a drop of CSF and put, if you've got a, you know, a good counter and you put a microscope slide on it and you put the right amount of CSF in. If you're a million miles away from a good lab, it's probably worth figuring out how to do those things and acquire those skills. But otherwise, it needs to be really at a lab within probably 12 hours.
Does the same hold true for the PCRs? You mentioned sending CSF for PCR.
PCRs are pretty stable. You can get DNA out of paraffin embedded tissue and still work with it.
Okay, so you could still send it off for that. You can look in-house for inflammatory cells and then send it off for that.
That's right.
Okay, so anti-inflammatory doses of breads. What do you classify as an anti-inflammatory dose of bread?
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit higher than most. For dogs, 0.25 to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram twice a day initially, and then tapering off if you're not going any higher. My immunosuppressive dose for dog would be 1 mg/kg BID. For a cat, double that. In large dogs, I'll often calculate the dose per meter squared rather than milligrams per kilogram, because big dogs tend to do, you know, they just don't seem to tolerate steroids nearly as well as small dogs. Still, both big and small dogs tolerate steroids better than people do. And then when you get to immunosuppressive doses of corticosteroids, the other important thing is you need to add in something else as well. So my usual recipe will be to start immunosuppressive doses of steroids and then add something. Your options are cyclosporin or cytisine or arabinoside or azathioprine or mycophenolate or leflunomide.
Which one do you use? It's a long list.
it really is. And usually what we do is we use one of them until it stops working, and then we move on to the next, and then to the next, and then to the next. Cyclosporin is probably the easiest. You know, it's twice daily. It's oral tablets that you can give at home. You can write a script. If you do write a script, you want to make sure it's the microemulsion that you get, the equivalent of the neoral. And the other thing about cyclosporin is that when you're using it, we would commonly use it at a 5 mg/kg BID dose. And you ideally run a trough serum level a week after you start, because some dogs at that 5 mg/kg dose will have a serum level of over 800, whatever it is, micrograms per milliliter. And you only need it to be above about 250. So for some of those dogs, you can drop the dose significantly. Some dogs, you start at 5 mg/kg BID and they'll have a serum level of 300 or 400, so you don't need to change the dose. But in some dogs, you can drop the dose from there. The cyclosporin side effects, the most common one are GI related, so vomiting and diarrhea. but generally it's pretty safe and it's pretty easy. In the UK, depending on where you are, you know, in the UK and the States, a lot of neurologists will reach to cytisine or abinocide as your first extra immunosuppressive dose. But that's a little bit more tedious because you've got to give it as an infusion, really. You should treat it like a cytotoxic agent that you're giving as part of chemotherapy. And it's just a little bit more painful. Our protocols, traditionally, we've done, you know, one dose every 3 weeks, which is an infusion over 12 hours or 8 hours at least, every 3 weeks for three doses, and then every 4 weeks for four doses, and then every 5 weeks for five doses. There's been some suggestion, there was a paper out of the UK that suggested you can just do a single infusion at the beginning, and it's almost as good as doing the whole other rigmarole. But I think our experience is that sadly it probably isn't. And then at the same time as you're doing all of this, you've started your steroids at an immunosuppressive dose and do that for 6 weeks, and then you taper it by half every 6 weeks until it's off.
Is that for the MUOs, or does the same hold true for the steroid responses?
So for the MUOs, we use, you know, prednisolone plus, and for the SRMAs, prednisolone on its own is fine.
So same protocol. Same protocol, better outcome.
Yeah. Curative rather than remission.
Okay. And is it categorically going to be six weekly reduction, or do you monitor response? Do you monitor CRP at all?
Yeah. So for the SRMA, there is a paper out there that says actually what you can do is taper in response to the CRP, but not all of them will have an elevated CRP at the beginning. So you don't always get to use CRP to guide your tapering. There are, you know, again, a couple of earlier studies have suggested that you can look at CSF cell counts and taper that way, but it's a bit painful and expensive to do a CSF tap every 6 weeks. And similarly, the early, you know, definitive diagnostic tools was to look at some IgA levels within CSF, and again, to taper in response to IgA levels, but you're back with the same problem. You really don't want to be knocking out and doing CSF taps every 6 weeks.
Okay. So we're kind of sticking to 6 weekly cycles. And if you taper and they get worse, then you bang up again to the previous
dose. Yeah, pretty much. There are some dogs where we have to do it every 8 weeks. There's a study out of North Carolina in the past couple of weeks that suggests maybe you don't need to do it quite so. You know, the 6 weeks is maybe a little bit of overkill, but I generally have found that 6 week number, it gives you the most reliable response.
And is it for both the drugs, for the MUOs that you've got a steroid plus?
For the MUOs, you leave your second immunosuppressant going for as long as you can, and the likelihood is that it eventually will stop working. It's a bit like, you know, lymphoma protocols, you know, once they're in remission, you keep going, but then at some point the cancer cells seem to become resistant, and the same with the inflammatory cells in the MUO, they seem to become resistant, we think, to the immunosuppression. The interesting thing is that the median survival times for, there have been a bunch of papers now looking at all of these individually, cyclosporin, cytarabine, AZT, mycophenolate, and all of them, when you put them all in a row, have roughly similar survival times of, again, on average, about 2 odd years, 2 to 3 years, in the order of sort of 1,200 odd days. But because it's an average, you just don't know what each individual dog in front of you is going to do. Some of those, it'll be 6 months before they stop responding to the cyclosporin and you have to use something else. And some dogs, it'll be 3 years.
Generally, let's say you start on cyclosporin and you get 6 months or 3 months, they do worse and you swap it to azathioprine or something. Do they generally respond, or do they respond less the second round?
That's also a good question. Just to sort of clarify, the other thing I'll do is bump the pred back up to immunosuppressive doses at the same time and then start the wean all over again. So it's probably the combination of the two that shows improvement. My own kind of personal feeling is that the necrotizing encephalitis cases tend to respond slightly less well than the GMEs. You don't get quite back to where you were with each successive failure, if that makes sense.
Kind of makes sense if you've got holes in your brain. It's not going to really, You're not going to plug the holes with preds, are you?
That's right. There's a little bit less you can rescue. Yeah.
That's really insightful. That's clarified a lot of things for me. Am I missing anything, Sam? I'm sure I'm missing a lot, but that's a good start.
we've covered. I would have said we've covered most of the important stuff, I reckon.
And very briefly, these conditions—they're not a thing in cats, right?
I don't think so. Again, my personal feeling versus the evidence. There are a couple of papers out there that have diagnosed MUO in cats, but I think it's almost certainly a fundamentally different disease, and I just don't think we certainly don't see it in the same sort of numbers. And I think it probably fundamentally is something else.
So cats are more like humans, more likely going to be infectious or something else.
Probably, yeah.
Marvelous. Sam, thank you so much for that. Thank you for your time and for jumping on.